Are you ready to elevate your personal or business brand with a professionally self-published book, but you keep getting repeatedly stuck time and time again? If you've been burned by bad advice, my friend, overwhelmed by the fire hose of information, or simply don't know where to turn, listen in for straightforward, actionable publishing guidance without the fluff, so you can avoid the biggest and costliest mistakes new authors make. Self-publishing for professionals is your roadmap to becoming a published thought leader. So today is basically an overview of self-publishing, like the steps you need to take to self-publish your book. Most of these apply, all of these up to the point where obviously you're uploading on KDP are going to apply even if you're going to a publisher. But the main difference is like if you're going with a publisher, you would need to like either query a hybrid publisher and or get it, pay an agent to query a traditional publisher. And not that you need to do get an agent to get a traditional publisher, but a lot of people do because it's a lot easier. Of course, that's a whole nother investment, something we're not going to talk about today, but I just wanted to make that distinguishment here. But all of these steps, even if you go with a publisher is still going to have to take to publish your book, because if you're going to publish even with a publisher, they're still going to put you on KDP. So this is the big overview. I'm not going into super detail, but if either of you ladies have any questions as I'm going along, just jump in and ask the question. And then if you have like a question for later, you can always throw it in the chat, but I probably won't be checking the chat as often just because I'm following along with the presentation. So today, what we're going to learn is we're going to focus on the key steps to writing and publishing your book on Amazon. Okay, so you want to follow these steps to successfully self-publish your book. And the other thing is you want to have these in order, because if you do them out of order, that's going to cost you extra time and money. That is not time and money well spent. That's one of the things you want to definitely do, is do these things in order. There's four key components to your book. And I talk about this in my book, From Idea to Outline. And in the Jumpstart course, we're going to have this July. That's coming up in, well, just like 3 or 4 more weeks. So anyway, you want to know these key components before you start writing. Now, if you started writing already, that's okay. Like you don't have to be like, oh, I have to rewrite my book. But even if you've started writing your book, you can still do this exercise and then go back to your book and see, does your book have all of these checkpoints in it? If it doesn't, then you can change your book and add these to it, or edit your book to add these to it. So one is, why are you writing your book? Two is, what is the focus of your book? Three is your book's message. And four is your book's target audience. Now, no matter what genre you are writing for, these are four key elements you want to know before you start writing, because this really helps you tune in your book's message and get your book like really highly focused on your reader. So number one, why are you writing a book? Do you want to become a well-known author? Do you want to make $1 million with your book? Are you writing a book to use as a business card? Or do you just want to leave a legacy? Like, because there's people that just write a book to leave their legacy and they order like 50 copies and give it to all their family members. That's another reason. Joanna and Cheryl, go ahead and unmute. And Joanna, you go first. Why are you writing your book? Like, what is your why for your book?
That's a very good question. I'm writing my book because I want my generations of family to know about my trials and tribulations, my will to adapt and learn and overcome situations, and the things that we survive as a family growing up. So that would be my way to share with my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and on, brothers, sisters. That is the main reason why I'm writing my autobiography.
So your main reason is legacy.
Yes.
Awesome. I love that. Cheryl, how about you?
Yeah. So the 7 books that I already published, the focus of those was to take all of the stories that have been shared in my podcast and use that material to write middle grade books with those stories to try and encourage them to do good in the world. And the current book that I'm working on has come out of that. And it's going to be a guidebook for Girl Scouts or anybody that's looking to do their own project, and a walkthrough of steps on how to do that. So it's to help them, you know, a self-help type book.
Very cool. So yours is also part inspirational, part self-help, part like guidebook. So yours is big piece of is educating people so they can bring Girl Scouts to the highest level they can be. I love that. I love that. Those are both amazing reasons to write a book. I love those reasons. And I actually love those reasons better than I want to make $1 million with the book, because to make $1 million for the book obviously would be nice, right? No, I'm never going to say no, I don't want to make $1 million with any of my books. But I feel like the purpose behind your book and your why behind your book is so much more important than the actual amount of money that you make, because the money that you make is definitely going to make obviously an impact on your finances. But I feel like when you have these deep whys, like you both ladies have, it extends more and deeper into like, into just like the world around you. So I really, really love that. And I admire you both for writing your books. That's really amazing. The next thing you want to know is, what is the focus of your book? Do you want to become a well-known author? Do you want to use your book as a business card? Do you want to like leave a legacy? What is the focus of your book? So what intention do you have when you're writing your book, basically? Now, your message. You said, Joanna, yours was like resilience and telling your grandkids and your family like what you had to go through to get to where you're at now. And then for Cheryl, your message is, hey, you can achieve this high level. Here's a guidebook on how to get there. Whether it's either one of those, or if you've got like a framework like I have in my book, or you have an efficient process that you want to share with other people, or learning how to get through a situation like survival guides, things like that. There's a lot of different messages. So one of my books I wrote for a client, and I have it right here, called Dreams Take Flight. So this is a book from my client, Tom, and we published it when he turned 80. So you're never too old to publish a book. And so the basis behind his book is he wanted to leave a legacy because he is the person that's responsible for disc golf being so popular in the world, like literally. And he literally lives in my town. He lives 10 minutes from my house, which is kind of funny. And so he found me online and hired me to help him write his book. When we were talking about his stories, the same message came up over and over again, where people would be like, no, you can't build that course there. And he would go and find a way to build it. Or people would say, no, you can't do this. And he's like, no, I'm going to do it. So his message in his book is, no matter what people tell me, I'm going to figure out a way to do it. So it's like that resilience piece. It's that problem solving piece. And then another client book who just published a couple of weeks ago, this is The Guy in the Yellow Tie. So this is another book that I helped my client with. And his message is resilience. Keep getting knocked down and getting picked back up. That's what his message is in his book. Every book has a different message, even if two books are on resilience. The resilience message is always just a bit different. The next step is you need to figure out who your target audience is. For example, I know when I'm writing my second edition of my Guide to Traveling Gluten-Free that my target audience is women ages 30 to 60 who either have celiac disease or whose family members have celiac disease. Typically, they're married or they have a partner and they're raising kids or helping to raise grandkids, or they have grandkids and they need this information to learn like what is safe to feed my family and what is not safe to feed my family or myself. And so, and I know this because with my podcast, I look at my demographics and all my demographics consistently fall in this category. If I was being really, really specific, it would be 40 to 55 because that's really my core. But then I've got a lot of women in between the ages of 30 and 60 because that's typically when a lot of people find out they have celiac disease, because it takes up to 10 years to get diagnosed sometimes, which is really sad. But anyway, you need to know who your target audience is and be as specific as possible, because you don't want to write for everybody. Because as we know, if you write for everybody, you write for nobody. Let's unmute. And Cheryl, I'm going to have you go first. Your target audience is pretty easy. So tell us your target audience. And if there are any target audience people who you're like, oh, I didn't think it would be going to be this, and you were surprised by some of your target audience.
Yeah, my target audience is pretty specific. It is middle schoolers that are Girl Scouts. Because of the way my books are written, I can reach other middle schoolers that are, or high schoolers that are looking for community service, project work, significant project work, that kind of thing. But when I'm writing, my niche is those middle school Girl Scouts. Of course, because they're the middle school Girl Scouts, I always also have to keep in mind the adults that support them.
Right. No, but I love that community service piece, because that's a really good point, because there's a lot of other like groups and schools that you have to do community service for. And like, what a better way to do it than joining a Girl Scout and getting an award while you're doing the community service. So it's like a double award for doing something good. And I really love that. And that's awesome. Thanks for sharing. Okay, Joanna, who do you think your target audience is? Obviously, you want your family members to read it, but outside your family members, who do you feel like your target audience might be?
So my target audience that I can identify being at this point is going to be a group of individuals under an umbrella of areas. And I can break that down just a little bit. Like people who have lived through the sandwich generation, where you're taking care of children and parents. Also teen mothers, anyone who went through the teen mothers scenario and situation, people who have lived with or are living with mental health situations, people who struggle with chronic medical conditions. So a lot of the things that I've been through, I'm hoping as I'm telling my story and sharing with my family and how we survived it and what we did, maybe other people that are in those areas. So it's a broad area. I know that, but it's going to be targeted to specific situations that people live through. Another one is really big for me because I have four boys who are in their 40s living through teenage years. That was tough. So just situations, you know, that people go through raising families, you know, growing up, learning, education, walk. So that's my target audience. And I'm going to narrow that down a little bit, but with my autobiography, just my whole path will be in there. So that's going to be a lot of things I'm going to be touching on. And I don't know if people are going to be able to relate or not, but I'll just share what worked and what didn't for me. Doesn't make my way right or wrong. It just makes it my way.
Yeah, I love that. And two, you're clearly appealing to an audience that's 40 plus, right? Because these are going to be people that have already lived life experiences. It's not going to be like the younger crowd that your book's going to appeal to, because you have to live these life experiences. You have to have life under your belt in order to relate to a lot of the things that are in your book. So yeah, I mean, I feel that's still pretty niche what you got. Like, you've got it niched down a little bit, but I would say even adding 40 plus would niche it down even more.
That's what I'll do. Thank you.
Awesome. And remember, when you're doing the back of your book, you want to send that message to your avatar. So like, appeal to your avatar. Like, have you been in this situation? Blah, 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 right? Like, that's a really good selling point for the back of your book. Because there's two things. You probably experienced this as well. I know I have personally experienced this. When I buy a book, I look at two things. The cover has to appeal to me, and I read the back of the book. And if it relates to me and I really like it, I'll buy it. But if it doesn't relate to me, I put it back on the shelf. So I'm sure you guys probably relate to that. That is a very, very typical common way people choose the books that they're going to read. And the topper to that is people will make that decision in less than 10 seconds. That's just hardly any time, right? But that's how fast our brains look at something and decide yes or no. And that's from just like all these years, like having for us to like make a decision really quickly when we used to be hunter gatherers and things like that. And now we still do that, but we do it with books and other things. The next step after you figure out those four things is you want to make an outline. You know, I tell people, some people are pantsers, which means they just sit down and just start to write whatever. And that's fine. You can do that. But you really do want to start with an outline. And the reason I tell everybody this is that because if you don't start with an outline and you just start writing your book, you're still going to have content, but it's not going to be focused on the four things we talked about earlier. And you're going to be writing a lot of content that may not make it into the book. So it's not a very efficient use of your time. And we cannot get back our time. So time is one of the things we want to be extremely careful with. There's a couple different ways you can do an outline structure for your book. You can do it chronological. That's what my client did in this one and actually this one, because they're both memoirs. And so memoirs set up really well for chronological, although you don't have to do a memoir in chronological. There's sequential, and then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And then there's topical, which is like categorical. And there's other ways too, but these are the three most common ways to set up your outline. This is would it be a categorical or topical way. I love mind maps. When I used to teach middle schoolers, when I first started teaching, I tried to teach them like the traditional outline, like Roman numeral one, blah, blah, blah. And then I started hearing sighs behind me as I was writing on the board. I'm like, okay, this is clearly not working. And then I found mind maps about 15 years ago. And these are really great because I'm not a linear thinker. And so I grew up learning the traditional outline, like you both probably did too, like Roman numeral one, blah, 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 big letter A. But since I'm not a linear thinker, that is not the best way for me to map out my ideas. I love using a mind map because I'm not a linear thinker. This also is really helpful for people who are visual learners because you can just really see what your book's going to be about. This is an example if I was writing a book marketing 101. These are some of the topics I could write about. Now, all of these topics on this little spoke wheel here are all going to be chapters, right? So this is the beauty of building out a mind map. You start with your main idea. And it doesn't have to be your title. And I tell people, You don't need to choose your title until you're finished formatting your book. But what I always recommend is keep a running list of titles and don't completely cross out your old ones, because sometimes you go back to your old ones and like, I like this word from this piece of title and this from this piece, and you end up combining them. So this is another idea of a mind map. This is somebody building a website, but same thing. You can do this with a book. So if this was a book about websites, this would be a chapter on subpages, and this would be information in the chapter about images, information in the chapter about navigation links, and information in the chapter about privacy policy. So as you go out, you can still build little spokes and more circles off of, and then these would be supporting underneath these. So you're actually building your book content when you are creating a mind map, which is magical about mind maps, I feel like, because this is such a simple tool that you can visually see what you're building and also construct all of the content for your book. Again, this is your main topic in the middle always, and then the first hub of your thing. So this would be header, homepage, subpages, footer, and sidebar in this example. These would be your chapters. And then anything coming off your chapters are subtitles in your chapters. And then anything coming off those subtitles are content underneath the subtitles. So you're literally building out the construct of your book. Now, again, books are a work of art. So your process can change, this can change, but you need to start somewhere and have a foundation to build on. So this is what's called it's basically like where you choose a yes or no, and I'm a dichotomy. So this is a dichotomy diagram. That's a mouthful. And I use these a lot in science as a teacher. And I love these because it's like a mind map, but it's more linear. So if you're more of a linear thinker, but you like the visual part, a dichotomy map is a great way to go, because it's basically a tree diagram where you extend subtopics off of different topics, right? So again, these would be your main topics here, would be your chapters. These would be your subtopics in your chapters, and these would be the supporting under that. And these top subtopics here would support these subtopics here. So any questions on mind maps before we move on? All right. And again, just pop in if you all have a question. Adding content to your mind map, you want to build your story. So there's lots of really great ways you can build your story besides just telling it from your, like, obviously you're going to tell it from your point of view, right? But you can give personal examples. You can do business or personal stories, depending on what type of book you're writing. You can talk about your framework or process. You can talk about your firsthand knowledge of something. You can talk about your secondhand knowledge of something, but just make sure you state that in your book, that this is something you got from another person. And so people know that. Or you can add research to your book, right? To build your story. So these are not all of the pieces of content you can use to build your story. These are just some main examples. But one of the things I always tell people and clients is a piece of advice I give them is, if you're going to have a story, the one criteria that has to fit is it has to support whatever you're talking about. Like, you can't just go into some random story that doesn't relate to your chapter or the piece that you're talking about. Like, for example, in my client Tom's book, he kept telling me more stories and more stories. I'm like, Tom, we need to add that to your book. He's like, no, I don't know. I'm like, Tom, you're 80 years old. No one's going to care about, like, no one's going to arrest you for pot you smoked when you're 18, right? So like, and that was back in the 60s and everybody smoked pot pretty much. So anyway, that's what I said. So I love the colorful stories, because that also not only gives your book more, like, more colorful stories and more fun things to read, but it really draws your reader in with that emotional piece, right? So stories are great because they build emotional connections with your reader. So even if you're doing a business book, I always recommend putting personal stories in there. Like with my travel gluten-free book, that was my first book, so I didn't know a lot about writing books. So with my second edition, I am definitely adding more stories in there, because A, I now have more stories because I've traveled much more since I've written my first book. And B, those stories really connect with readers. So I'm going to add them in there. So once you have everything outlined and you have most of your content that you know you're going to use, like research and stuff, sorted into your folders. And what I recommend is putting one chapter for each folder. Now, a new thing I just learned from doing my second edition of my book and a second edition of a client's book is, if you're doing a second edition, it's actually easier to group your chapters in three. So like chapters 1 to 3 in one folder, 4 to 6 in the second folder, and so on. Unless you have a lot of research. If you have a lot of research, I recommend leaving it in a one chapter per folder. So like chapter 1, all of your information for chapter 1's in that folder, and so on and so forth. But one of the things I'm finding out with writing a second edition is, because I'm using my last edition, obviously, as a base, it's very hard to go back and forth. And the other thing I'm realizing too is when you're writing a second edition, you want to label all your second edition files second ed and then the title. Because one of the things I did the other day is I accidentally wrote my second edition in my first edition draft and I didn't realize that. Yeah, I know. Luckily, Google has the version history so I can revert it back. But I'm not too worried about it because I'm not going to write my first edition again. So I just kind of laughed and copied and pasted it in the right place. But that's when I'm like, I'm going to write second ed on the top of everything. So now that you're done your rough draft and you've written that, this is the part that comes your self-editing and your beta readers. So self-editing means you are going through your book and editing your own book, right? And then beta readers is you're asking other people to read your book and get feedback. So there's a couple of different ways to do beta readers. One is you can just ask people you know. You can put it out online. I announced it on my podcast because I knew a lot of my podcast listeners. Some of them would be interested in beta reading a book that's the same topic as the podcast. So if you have a podcast, this is an easy ask for people to come in and beta read your book. So I tell people you can read one chapter, you can read two chapters, you can read the whole book. It doesn't matter. Like if you read one chapter, that's fine. I consider you a beta reader because not everybody has time to read your whole book. And I'd rather somebody be invested in one chapter than not be invested at all and feel like this whole book is too overwhelming right now. Like, I can't do that. So that's my take on it. Everybody has a different take. One of the main things with beta readers is you're looking for feedback on like flow, understanding the concepts. Does this make sense? Does this not make sense? Does this relate to you? Do you feel like this is pulling you in? Don't want them to critique your grammar and copy. Although even every time I've done a beta reader thing, I've said, okay, don't critique my grammar copy. You always have someone who does it anyway. So I just say, thank you for critiquing my book and move on. Then once you do your beta readers and you self-edited it, you definitely want to hire a professional editor. And the reason I say this isn't because I'm a professional editor, is because I have read books that are not professionally edited and you can tell. I actually worked on a client's book about 3 months ago and I looked at her first book and I looked at her reviews on her first book. One quarter of her reviews on Amazon, she had like 70, so she had a decent amount of reviews, said one quarter said, I don't think this person had a professional editor. There's mistakes all over the place. And I was like, ouch, that really hurts your credibility because once you put that out, you can't get that back. And as we all know, reputation is the hardest thing to fix. That's one of the main reasons why you want to hire a professional editor, especially if you're a speaker and you're trying to get speaking gigs with your book, because you're not going to get the speaking gigs if you have a book. I mean, you're still going to get speaking gigs. But if an event coordinator looks at your book and there's a tons of mistakes in that, what does that signal to you? So I want your opinion before I'm going to tell you guys what it signals to me. So Cheryl and Joanna, you unmute first. If you were an event organizer and someone was like, hey, I want to speak at your event, and they gave you their book and it was full of typos and stuff, what would you think?
I would think definitely that they didn't take the time to get everything right. They didn't maybe put enough emphasis on following the guidelines that editors would like to see. And then I would think that I wouldn't want to read it because it would be a challenge. Instead of being fun and experiential, it will be more of a challenge to try to read and decipher what exactly, especially if there's like fragmented sentences, punctuations that are, you know, not coherent. So that's what I would think. I would definitely think that they just didn't follow the guidelines that editors would like to see, that it's professionally edited, is what I would think.
Good point. I didn't think of reading the book as a challenge, because if they're handing out the book at your event and people are reading it and they're like, why did they pick this person? This is such a challenge to read. But that's a really good point. I love that. Cheryl, what about you? If you were an event organizer and someone gave you a book that it was full of mistakes, what would be your first impression?
I liken it to the preparation phase. If you're not going to edit, have a professional editor for your book, how are you preparing for a presentation that you're going to give at my event?
Good point. I like that a lot. Yeah. So like if you're not going to be professional in your book, then you're probably not going to be professional at my event. And then that relates back negatively on me as the event coordinator, right? Because then these people are like, well, why did this person pick this person to do this book, this presentation? That's a good point. I love that. I really like that. So yeah, so you can't get that back. So especially if you're a speaker, you definitely want to hire a professional editor. So these are the four types of editing, because I get this question a lot, and I have a podcast episode on this as well. So I've got a couple of different podcast episodes on editing. So the first edit that you want to have for your book is developmental editing. One of the things you want to make sure is that your editor is not using AI to edit your book, because I know people do say like, oh, I put it in AI and it said this, but AI is not a good book editor. I can tell you that right now. It does an okay on certain pieces, but it's not good with context. And that's the main thing you want to see with an editor is they get your context, they understand what you're trying to get across and the message. And so AI doesn't understand that. And that's why it's not a good editor for your book. You can use it as part of your self-editing process, but again, it's going to get things wrong. Like, for example, I was reading a sample that someone had put out somewhere. And I said, it doesn't have, like, I don't know where I'm at. Like, I'm three paragraphs down and I still don't know the environment I'm in. I'm like, you need more environmental detail. And he's like, oh, funny. I put it in AI and it told me I was saying too much environmental detail. And I'm like, no, I don't even know where I was at until I was like down three pages in your first chapter. I'm like, that's not good. I need to know where I'm at. Like, the second I jump in your book. That's what AI does. Line editing, on the other hand, is so developmental editing is your overarching concepts and things like that. But line editing is when an editor goes line by line, right? And I read every line in the book and I give the author a better sounding book with more powerful wording, which strengthens your book. Because a lot of people, a very common thing a lot of people will do is they'll use what I call fuzzy words or non-powerful words like something, sort of, kind of, I think that this might work. Those things you want to take out of your book because they don't make you look confident and you want to look confident as an author. Even if you're wrong, that's okay. Because the confidence piece that comes across, and especially if you're using your book for a business book and you don't sound confident, why would someone hire you, right? Like, I'm not going to hire somebody who keeps telling me over and over again with their words in their book that they're doubting themselves. Copy editing. Once you get done the developmental line editing, copy editors catch the mistakes that the developmental and line editing did not do. And developmental line editing does not cover copy editing. And another thing I want to advise against is if you get an editor that says, I do all forms of editing, don't hire them. I don't do all forms of editing and I'm really good at what I do and I do it full time. I do developmental and line editing for nonfiction, period. Like that's my specialty and ghostwriting. But I don't do copy and proof, that I have other people who I team up with to do that. This is just like grammar mistakes. And then the proofreading catches any grammar mistakes and spelling mistakes that the copy editing did not do. And you can hire the same person for copy and proof because they're very, very similar. And that's typically what I do is I team up with somebody who does the copy and proof part because I do the developmental line editing piece. So editor qualifications. So these are just the basic six. I actually have a podcast episode on 22 questions you can ask your editor. And one of my friends in the school community said, wow, this is a lot of questions. I don't think I'd work with anybody who asked me this many questions. But the reason that person asked so many questions is because they were putting it on a job board. And the job board, typically you get like 40 to 50 people replying back. And I think that person was just trying to weed out anybody that was like, didn't want to fill out the form. Anyway, these are the top six that I picked as a professional editor. So one, the editor works in your genre. You don't want an editor that work like I work in any genre. No, you don't want someone like that. So I work in nonfiction and specifically like business, lifestyle, memoir, and self-help. And those are pretty much the four that I cover. They edit or write full-time. You don't want to hire somebody who has a different full-time job and then does ghostwriting on the side or does editing on the side. Because almost every problem I have talked to people with is with people who are editing or ghostwriting on the side to make extra money because they don't understand the process, they don't understand publishing, and they don't understand how to edit books correctly. They might have an English degree, but they don't know publishing. There's a difference between having an English degree and knowing publishing and what publishers are looking for and what a good book sounds like. All right. The editor answers all your questions. So if you're asking questions and they're not answering you, that's a huge red flag. They have a process that they follow, right? It might be different than another editor, but they have a clear process and you understand the process. If they can't tell you their process, then do not hire them. That means they're not a professional. The editor's open to communicating at any point in the process. Now, this doesn't mean that you can text the editor at 3 a.m. and they're going to answer you back. This means that if you have a question, you can email them or text them during normal business hours, and they'll respond within 48 hours, right? If they're not responding within 48 hours, besides the fact that they've had an emergency or something like that has happened, then you may want to find a different editor. And you can always ask them, what's your turnaround time for answering my questions? Mine is 24 hours for my clients. All right. They are respectful out of your point of view, your work, and your tone of voice. So they're not going in your book trying to change it all. I talk to people who have editors who have done that, and that's very not cool, right? My job is not to change your book. My job is to support your book. That's why I pick books that resonate with me, because then I can more easily support the author, right? I'm not going to pick a book that doesn't resonate with me because I can't do a good job for my client. So these are the top six. There's more editor qualifications. So definitely listen to that episode on the 22 questions to ask your editor to get more qualifications. But I think the biggest one, these are all really big, but the communication piece is really big because that's the one big red flag that's consistent across all editors that aren't good, is either they won't communicate with you. They tell you, oh, you can only reach out to me like once a month. That's a big red flag, or they don't get back to you in time. So the next step after you've purchased the editor and they're working on your book is you want to purchase ISBNs. Do not use the free Amazon ISBN. There's many reasons for this, but the biggest reason is if you get the free Amazon ISBN, you think you're saving yourself some money, but you're really not. Because when you have the Amazon ISBN, the only platform you can ever sell your book on is Amazon. You can't even purchase your own book and sell it at, like, if you're doing a workshop or a speaking engagement. So you want to go to Balker, which is a US company, and you want to buy a set of 10, because one ISBN is 125 and a set of 10 is like 250. So that's a no-brainer, because you need one ISBN for each format of your book. So one for audiobook, one for paperback, one for hardcover, and one for ebook. So one of my books, I have I've got an ebook, a paperback, and an audio. So I've used three ISBNs just for that one book. Go on Balker, buy the set of 10. And then you need to assign your ISBN. So like, this ISBN is for my paperback. This one's for my ebook. This one's for my audiobook. So you need to assign them on Balker before you upload your book into KDP. Book cover design. While the person is working on your editing, you can have your book cover designer start to work. Again, there's many similarities between hiring a book cover designer and hiring an editor. So make sure you ask them lots of questions and get samples from them. And also, I would also say, get two pieces of client referrals, because one of the things I'm finding with samples on like Fiverr and Upwork is I think they're screenshotting other people's stuff and putting it on their portfolio. Because a lot, like, I've hired two different book cover designers on Fiverr, and the stuff that I was getting was not what was on their portfolios. So make sure you get referrals from, like, actual client referrals from people. You can start creating your ebook cover before you're finished paper formatting, but never start your paperback until your formatting is complete. I've seen so many authors make this mistake. And the reason why, you don't want to start your paperback cover until you're finished your formatting. And you don't want to start your formatting until you're completely finished all of your editing and you feel like, okay, now my book's ready to go. It doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be professional. All right. So your paperback cover is, you have to wait till your formatting is complete, because if you make any changes and it changes the amount of pages more or less than 10, then you have to reformat your entire book. I'm doing this for a client right now, and she said she approved her book. We formatted it, and I told her, make sure you approve. She said, yes, we formatted it. And then she's like, well, I want to change chapter one. So then she had to pay to reformat it, because then I had to change chapter one, re-edit it. She had just reapproved it the other day. And then now I'm taking that and putting it back into her book and reformatting her book. Once you have your book formatted, then your book cover designer can make your paperback book, because they know the exact number of pages it is. And you want to, because you have to know your book size too. A common book size is 8.5 by 5.5, which is this right here. See, this one might be a 6 by 9. The 6 by 9 and 8.5 by 5.5 are very common sizes that you see books come in. All right. So KDP upload, all right? So no matter what you're uploading, unless it's an audiobook, audiobooks you're going to upload on ACX. And that is not my specialty, that I refer out to other people. But if you're uploading an ebook, a paperback, or a hardcover, I assist people with KDP upload. So once you have your final manuscript, which means it is formatted. And the other thing with formatting is, never, ever hire somebody who formats your book in WordPerfect, because the pictures are all stretched out. It looks all wonky. It does not look professional. If you are hiring a book formatter, and ask them, what program do you use to format? If it's Adobe InDesign, that's fine. If it's Atticus, that's fine. If it's Vellum, that's fine. If it's like, there's a couple other that are professional, but if they say Word, just say, no, thank you, I'm not interested. Once you have your final manuscript properly formatted, not in Word, your ebook cover, your paperback cover, and your ISBN numbers have been already assigned to your books, and you want to assign them at least a week before, because it takes some time to process it in the system and Amazon has to recognize it. Then you can take these elements and upload them into Amazon. So you go through the Amazon process, and you fill out all the boxes, including your name, if you want to add anybody as an editor or contributor, things like that. All right. So that is the basic overlay of what you need to do to write, edit, and publish your book on KDP. If you need any other information, you can reach out to me at writeforyou.me. Write for You Self-Publishing. So Cheryl and Joanna, do you have any questions on the process?
Okay, Joanna. I don't have any questions about the process. You laid them out pretty in detail, but can you elaborate on what KDP stands for?
Yeah, that's actually, somebody asked me that the other day. So KDP stands for Kindle Direct Publishing. And so that just means any book that Amazon is selling, not just books on Kindle, but any book that is published on Amazon. So it can be professionally published with a publisher, traditional or hybrid, and published on Amazon as well, or you can self-publish it on Amazon. But KDP just stands for Kindle Direct Publishing. When you upload your book onto Amazon, you have a KDP bookshelf, which is all of your books you have published on Amazon.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, did you have any questions?
I don't have any questions. I'll just add one comment of something that I found when I was publishing my books, and that is make sure to publish. I agree. You have your own ISBNs, but publish to KDP before you publish anywhere else. So like I also publish to Ingram Spark because I want libraries to be able to order my books. And you have to do Kindle KDP first before you do Ingram Spark, because otherwise Amazon gets mad at you.
Yes, exactly. Right. You have to do them in the right order. That is a good point. Very good point. Awesome. This has been awesome. So we'll wrap up here. But if you guys need any assistance, you can get a hold of me in the school community, Publishing for Leaders, or you can get a hold of me on writeforyou.me.
Thanks for joining me today on the Self-Publishing for Professionals podcast. If you found the information on today's show valuable, be sure to subscribe and follow and get the next episode dropped as soon as it's published. This podcast is brought to you by Unicorn Publishing Company. The information in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The content shared by the host, guests, and any affiliates is not intended to substitute for professional, legal, or financial advice or any professional advice specific to your situation. Always seek the advice of a qualified professional with any questions you may have. The opinions expressed on the show by the host or guests are those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect the views of Unicorn Publishing Company. Unicorn Publishing Company, the host, guests, and affiliates are not responsible or liable for any decisions made by listeners or actions taken hereto based on the information discussed in this podcast. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to release Unicorn Publishing Company, the host, affiliates, and guests from any liability.